From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This call originated from a correctional facility.
We, as a nation, have to address the problem of crime and punishment. Each time there is an execution across this country, whether it's Sam McDonald or someone in Florida, Texas, etc., or myself, you know, it's a loss for all of us.
Death row prisoner A.J. Bannister. He has a date to die Tuesday night at midnight. We'll look at the execution protocol inside America's capital punishment industry. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney General Janet Reno yesterday took the next step in a legal process that could lead to an independent counsel investigation of President Clinton's phone calls to donors, saying she needed more time to determine whether there's evidence he made any illegal solicitations from the White House. Faced with a deadline today to either extend the probe or drop it, Reno told a special three-judge panel yesterday she decided to move to the preliminary investigation allowed under the Independent Counsel Act to resolve several factual and legal questions. Reno acted on the eve of her appearance before a House panel where she faces a grilling by Republicans. The president in Brazil promised to cooperate in the inquiry and said, "I know I didn't do anything wrong." The Supreme Court rejected a challenge to an Oregon law allowing doctor-assisted suicides, clearing the way for the law to take effect. State voters, however, are being asked to repeal it in a referendum next month. Older Americans die in widely different circumstances depending on where they reside, this according to a big Dartmouth study. Findings show those in Miami, New York City, and parts of South Texas are especially likely to face the end in a hospital, while dying at home is more common in many Western states. Two AIDS experts have resigned in protest from the editorial board of the New England Journal of Medicine because they object to the handling of articles criticizing the ethics of a number of federally financed AIDS studies in developing countries. The scientists, Dr. David Ho and Dr. Catherine Wilfert, said in separate interviews that they had resigned largely because the journal had not consulted them before publishing an editorial comparing the AIDS research to the notorious Tuskegee experiment, in which poor black men suffering from syphilis were left untreated. Congo Republic's presidential palace fell to fighters allied with former military ruler Denis Sassou Nguesso, who appears to be close to defeating the forces of President Pascal Lissouba. UN intervention was weighed, reports mounted of Angolan attacks in support of Sassou Nguesso. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agreed to back stronger Orthodox control over Israeli religious affairs, angering Reform and conservative Jews. Orthodox parties had threatened to bring down his government over the issue. Separately, Netanyahu released all the Palestinian funds he froze after recent bombings. Iran has accused a U.S. destroyer and plane of shadowing its Persian Gulf naval maneuvers and said they were ordered out of the area. The U.S. denied the charge and said the ship has been in port since Monday. Queen Elizabeth laid a wreath at Jallianwala Bagh in the Indian city of Amritsar in an act of homage to the victims of an attack in 1919 by British troops on a crowd of about 10,000 unarmed Indians protesting an extension of World War I detention laws. The event galvanized India's freedom movement. Adrian Vlok, a former South African cabinet minister, alleged that the thousands of cases of murder and torture committed by security officers in the apartheid era in South Africa resulted from misunderstood orders. The National Party government's use of words like elimination and neutralization, he told the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, were never intended as orders to kill. California's Treasurer Matt Fong has halted the state's dealings with Swiss banks while investigators look at the bank's role in handling funds stolen from Holocaust victims by Nazi Germany, a spokesperson for Mr. Fong said. The spokesperson confirmed that Union Bank of Switzerland was among the firms affected, but did not immediately identify others. The California announcement followed the decision by New York City Comptroller Alan Hevesy to drop the bank from a syndicate backing a city debt issue. And policymakers met in Santa Monica, California, to prepare for wild weather this winter, courtesy of El Nino. Al Gore, the vice president, Senator Barbara Boxer of California, and the director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency were among those at the summit. The phenomenon occurs every 2 to 7 years when warmer water pushes across the Pacific Ocean to South America, affecting weather worldwide. Some meteorologists say this El Nino is the most powerful in 150 years. And that's some of the news at this hour. By turning down an appeal, the Supreme Court has cleared the way for Oregon's doctors-assisted suicide law to go into effect. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The death penalty in the United States is growing at a steadily increasing pace. With 59 people already put to death this year, executions are running at a 40-year high. In fact, the country has not seen so many executions since the Eisenhower years, when 65 people were executed in 1957. Among those scheduled to die this next week is convicted murderer Alan Jeffrey Bannister, known as A.J. Bannister. He's a death row prisoner in Missouri. After 13 years, his appeals have been exhausted, and the state of Missouri plans to execute him by lethal injection in the early morning hours of next Wednesday, that's Tuesday night. But this will be no ordinary execution. The eyes of the world are fixed on A.J. Bannister's case. He's been the subject of two celebrated BBC documentary films, The Execution Protocol, which was made in 1992, and Raising Hell, The Life of A.J. Bannister, which was made in 1995. And international law and human rights groups have launched campaigns on his behalf. Today on Democracy Now!, we're going to take an in-depth look at the capital punishment industry in the United States and the actual process of executing a human being. We'll go behind the walls of Potosi Correctional Center in Missouri to speak directly with death row prisoner A.J. Bannister. But joining us right now is Stephen Tremblay. He's the director of the award-winning film The Execution Protocol, as well as a book by the same title. Let's talk about America's capital punishment industry, and in your case, what you discovered through your work at the Potosi Correctional Center outside St. Louis, Missouri. There you interviewed and followed the prison execution team and the lives of three condemned men, including A.J. Bannister. What did the prison officials and the people directly involved with executions have to say about their work?
The then warden, who's since retired, a fellow called Paul Dillo, said to me very early on when I met him, I view myself, as others do here, as an instrument of the state. And that is kind of a chilling thing to be, an instrument of the state. Paul Dillo is a man for whom I have a certain amount of respect for the way he conducted his job during his tenure there. I don't believe he enjoyed putting nearly a dozen men to death. If he were not the warden of that prison, someone else would be. Interestingly, to jump ahead a little bit, in 1994, when A.J. Bannister came within 2 hours of execution, I spoke to the warden a few weeks later by telephone, and he was glad to get my call, and the first thing he said to me before I could ask him anything was, I'm glad I didn't have to kill A.J., and by implication, no one else anymore. Some of the people who do that job are sadistic. Some of them gain a great deal of pleasure. There is actually, around times of execution, almost a sexual tension amongst some of the staff involved in it. It is a very, very strange thing to behold.
What do you mean?
There is a kind of killing frenzy. And it's different from the kind of killing frenzy that can happen in hunting. You know, when young and inexperienced hunters get very excited by taking their first game or taking too much game. It's something that one imagines really only happens in wartime. Almost a lust for killing and a lust for legalized killing.
It is
pretty interesting when you think about it, that here, something that is illegal in this country, and in most countries, it's not considered a good thing to kill someone, in a certain context, in a limited place, it is considered the right thing to do, and so taboos are turned on their heads.
It seems to me that the death penalty isn't actually an aspect of justice at all. It seems to me that it is primarily a retributive phenomenon. And I say this because, you know, it's the eye for an eye argument. You killed, so we kill you. Now, if you step back and look at other crimes that are committed anywhere, we don't actually punish most criminals by applying to them, making them a victim of the same crime. Right? We don't rape rapists. We don't have a state raper to rape the rapist. You know, and we don't do things that do happen, for instance, under Islamic law, like cutting off the hands of thieves. Death penalty stands completely outside normal justice.
We're talking to Stephen Trombley. He is the author of The Execution Protocol, Inside America's Capital Punishment Industry. He also did a documentary film by the same title, The Execution Protocol. Talk a little about lethal injection and how Missouri uses it. How exactly a person is executed?
Under Missouri's lethal injection program, and this applies to many other states, the inmate is taken out of general population anywhere from 2 days to a week prior to the execution and held in a holding cell, which is a cage, a 6x9 metal cage that has nothing in it but a toilet and a bunk. And just out, and that cage is contained within a very small room. And inside the room is a guard who sits at a desk 24 hours a day with a telephone, recording everything the inmate does, making a note of when he sleeps, when he wakes, when he has a telephone call, when he goes to the lavatory, if he asks for something. And depending on the state, he is allowed some or few or more visits, generally only by family members or people who are on his approved visiting list. As the date approaches, in Missouri, he's able to use the telephone to make collect calls to people and can receive some incoming calls at the discretion of the institution. On the morning of the execution, he is examined by the prison doctor to make sure that he's healthy. It's one of the strange ironies of the way we perform executions that a man must be judged fit and healthy to be executed in mind and in body. In the afternoon prior to the execution, the inmate begins to receive a series of injections and orally ingested medications, including antihistamines, which have the effect of reducing spasm when the lethal chemicals are injected. Early experiments in lethal injection were very ugly to watch for spectators, because really you drown. You are asphyxiated in that death, and people would thrash about, choke and cough and splutter. By administering antihistamines, they lay perfectly calm and just expire quietly. Sedatives are given beginning in the afternoon, numerous of them. In Missouri, they use a sedative called Versed, which is a very, very strong tranquilizer, much, much stronger than Valium, so that by the time you are strapped to the table and ready for execution, you are really quite sedated. The fight is out of you. Very few men who die from lethal injection make a last statement that is coherent, because most of them are unable to. Their thoughts are away from them. The chemicals are applied in a 3-minute sequence, 1-minute interval between them, a sedative, an artificial curare, a heart-stopping drug, and then potassium chloride, which stops the lungs. So basically, your respiratory system and your heart are paralyzed, and it is a death that is rather like drowning. And it takes, on average, 7 minutes for the subjects to die. But often there are problems. There can be kinks in the line. There are half a dozen documented examples of the lethal injection machinery failing and for the process to take up to half an hour.
In your book, you talk about a man who has the control module of his lethal injection machine right in his basement.
The lethal injection machine was invented by a man named Fred Lucher. Fred Lucher is a strange character. He is a Holocaust revisionist, a right-wing, extreme right-wing theorist who claims that the gas chambers in Auschwitz never existed. He's a hero of the extreme right. And he made it his business during the 1980s when executions began to increase. He saw an opportunity to create a new style, a new manner of doing it. And most states who were conducting executions employed him during the 1980s. He redesigned the electric chair for the modern period, although it is going out of fashion. Not many states use it. He created the lethal injection machine, which is now the standard method in most states.
That's an unbelievable story that I've never heard before.
Fred Lucher, when his Holocaust revision activities, his extreme right-wing sympathies began to be known, was pretty quickly shunned by the corrections community in America, and one by one, his contracts went away. And most of those states have gone along very nicely without him. Once the machine had been purchased, it spawned many imitators, and so copies of it have been built by numerous states. And he will go down in history as having created the first new method of execution since the gas chamber.
Now, he's both responsible for lethal injection, but also for the electric chair.
Yes. Fred Lucher redesigned the electric chair in terms of making a careful study of what is really quite a simple matter. You know, how much voltage at what amperage should pass through a human being of a specific size for what duration at what intervals to kill him. And no one has really bothered very much to work that formula out. Who cares? People who are executing men in electric chairs aren't really concerned for their comfort. And so we had, during the 1980s, numerous instances of people being cooked alive in the electric chair, most notably a man called Jesse Tefero in Florida whose hair was on fire, whose eyeballs burned out. There were people who had been cooked so badly that when they came to take them out of the chair, the flesh fell away from their arms like overcooked chicken. Now, while some states, members of the public and corrections personnel alike, might not care about that, it was having a negative effect. It was bad publicity for executions. In America, we like executions, but we don't really want them to be messy. I think the situation we're in now is we would like to see everyone on death row cleared out in a hurry. What we don't want to do is read about it over our cornflakes in the morning. We don't want to be reminded of it. We just want the garbage taken out and taken out cleanly. And lethal injection does that. Lethal injection leaves no outward signs. There is nothing to watch. Journalists have stopped going to watch, to witness lethal injection executions because there's nothing to report. It's a sanitizing process.
You've been listening to Stephen Tremblay. He's the author of The Execution Protocol Inside America's Capital Punishment Industry. We'll finish with him in the next segment, and then we'll go to death row prisoner A.J. Bannister. Stay with us here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we take a look at today's America's capital punishment industry with author and filmmaker Stephen Tremblay. Later, we'll speak directly with Missouri death row prisoner A.J. Bannister, scheduled to die next Tuesday. But first, we continue our conversation with Stephen Tremblay. Tell us about the gas chamber.
The gas chamber probably will never be used again in the United States. It was popular, especially in some southern states and out west in the middle of the century. It's a very dangerous thing to use. I mean, just the basic facts of it, of releasing noxious gas into a room, which a very small amount of can kill even the spectators. You have to create a completely sealed, airtight, gas-proof chamber, which is possible but difficult to maintain over long periods of time. The last time the gas chamber had been used in Mississippi, the solution they found when they realized it leaked was to smear the windows and all the joints with gobs and gobs of Vaseline. Clearly, a piece of technology from a bygone era, and one with some really pretty nasty repercussions for those who might remember what happened in World War II.
Stephen Tremblay, speaking of World War II, I wanted to ask you about physicians' involvement with administering the death penalty in prisons around America.
The Hippocratic Oath specifically forbids the kind of activity that involves a physician in taking a life. And let's leave the euthanasia argument out of that, or assisted suicide at the patient's request. That's another argument. More specifically, the American Medical Association has published guidelines, not guidelines, obligations to physicians, forbidding them to participate in executions. Yet they do. Every state requires physician involvement in an execution. Generally, a physician monitors the dying heartbeat of the inmate. Generally, a physician declares death. And in some cases, physicians are involved in directing the medical personnel who set the IV lines. The intravenous lines are pretty much set by nurses, contract nurses who come in. And I would say that nurses, like doctors, ought to be covered by the same kind of guidelines and prohibitions. For a doctor to examine a patient, to examine an inmate prior to execution, many inmates on death row have been habitual drug users throughout their lives before their final arrest. Many of them have collapsed veins. It's not infrequent that the doctors, nurses cannot immediately find a vein, and they have to find an artery. So very often incision has to be made to find an artery in the neck or the groin, lift the artery out and expose it, and then insert the IV. And this is not the work of a nurse. This is work performed by a doctor or a surgeon. And even when a nurse performs these tasks is at the direction of a doctor.
Now, can you tell us, Stephen Tremblay, about A.J. Bannister and his case? A.J. Bannister on death row, or capital case in the Missouri Potosi prison, who is sentenced to die Tuesday at midnight.
A.J. Bannister's case is in some ways very simple. At the age of 23, he shot a man in the course of an argument. The man died. Bannister was arrested, held in a county jail for nearly a year, during which time he saw his court-appointed attorney for less than 1 hour. The trial lasted 3 days. The lawyer mounted no defense, called no witnesses, not one, on his client's behalf. The jury debated the case for 2 hours, found him guilty, had lunch, debated his sentence for another hour and a half, decided it should be the death penalty, and went home inside in time for supper. Bannister is someone who is a small-time crook, a petty thief, a burglar, who'd had three previous convictions. Someone who received a three-year sentence for his first offense of stealing a car radio, which I think even today we would find kind of stiff. In his three stints in prison, he learned a lot of bad habits, met a lot of bad people. He ended up in 1983, as the result of a busted drug deal, being stabbed 4 times in the back, left for dead in a parking lot. When he recovered, he went back home, just wanted to find out who had ordered this stabbing. And he was told by fellow drug merchants that a man who was from Illinois but had since moved to Missouri was responsible. Bannister traveled to Missouri, knocked on the man's door, demanded to know why. They argued. Bannister shot him. The man dies. The evidence, the physical evidence from the scene, and Bannister's own accounts suggest that this is a second-degree murder case, which would carry a 20-year sentence. You might serve 10. A very good lawyer would probably succeed in getting a manslaughter charge. It is in no way a capital offense. It's a long way from being a capital offense. And that is really the injustice in Bannister's case. He is a confessed killer. He makes no bones about the fact that in the course of an argument, he shot a man and wishes he hadn't. But to be paying with his own life is an absurd price for the crime he committed.
You've been listening to Stephen Tremblay, author of The Execution Protocol, Inside America's Capital Punishment Industry, and director of an award-winning feature film by the same title. A.J. Bannister is one of the key figures in his book and video. The case of A.J. Bannister, as Stephen Tremblay has just been explaining, is hardly unique in the United States today. At the time that he was tried and sentenced to death in 1983, Bannister received little or no effective legal help. But what makes his story stand out is the international outcry over his case. Because of his leading role in these two powerful BBC documentary films, an international campaign has been launched calling on Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan to grant A.J. clemency. I got a rare chance to interview A.J. Bannister on Monday. He was speaking to him at the Potosi Correctional Facility outside St. Louis in Missouri. I asked him to describe in his own words how he ended up on death row.
In the summer of 1982, I got involved in a drug transaction that had went sour in Phoenix, Arizona. July 9th of 1982, I was stabbed for my part in this. Taken to the hospital, spent a week there, recovered, and left the hospital with an attitude because I'd basically been assaulted over something I had not done. Returned to Illinois, which is where I grew up, where this drug transaction transpired initially, returned and tried to locate the people that were involved in this, and I was given the name of a man here in Missouri. Traveled down here with the intention of confronting this individual about this, and got down here August 20th, 1982, and him and I met up. There was a struggle, and he lost his life and I lost my freedom. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly responsible for the loss of his life and have never denied that. But it was an accidental shooting during the course of a struggle. And that's pretty much been the basis for my claims for the last decade and a half.
So this is the case, the killing of Daryl Roisman, that has led to you being on death row.
Yes.
And is Tuesday the first date that has been set for you, or have you had other dates?
No. I've been through. I've had my first execution date was February 1st, 1985. And I think I've had probably seven or eight since that time. The most recent one was December 7th of 1994, and I was taken to within 2 hours of being put to death before a stay was upheld by the United States Supreme Court.
AJ, what is it like to face death so many times, to have had dates set for you so many times? What do you go through in those last hours?
Well, I don't know that there's any words that can be put to that. There's the losing of hope, and it's a slow process. I give a great deal of thought to my family and friends and the emotional trauma that they've been put through time and time again. And I'm certainly mindful of the victim's family, because in my case, they were, I believe the victim's family they certainly have rights. I mean, there can be no question on that. In my case, they were misled by the state's overzealous prosecution and were never given the truth on the true circumstances that were involved in this crime. And I believe they're owed that. I have never tried to deny my guilt. It's the degree of my guilt. And a great many people are aware that I'm certainly guilty of a crime. I accidentally took a man's life, and I have my dues to pay society for that. But paying with my life only creates another set of victims, and that's my family, my friends, those people that are aware.
This call originated from a correctional facility.
Those people that are aware of the facts of my case. And it's not a matter of my word against the state's in this. The record pretty much speaks for itself. And it's just a matter of someone taking the responsibility to look at the evidence that was not presented at trial. And it was certainly not my fault that I could not compel this defense attorney to put on a case. I certainly tried, and it was to no avail. And it's, even now, you know, with a little more than a week to go, I've learned a great deal from my previous experience some 3 years ago, and that is not to wait till the last minute to let people know what I think of them and how much I appreciated all their efforts, no matter what happens. And then, of course, there's a great deal of frustration on my part, because I've owned up to what I've done, ready to pay my debts, and still the state is unwilling to do the right thing.
What happens on death row when someone is executed there at the Potosi prison? How does the prison treat the rest of you on death row? How do you feel? Who was the last person to die there?
The last person to be executed here was Samuel McDonald on September 24th. And I'd known Sam for better than 14 years. And what really struck me about his case was that this was a man who served his country in Vietnam, not by his own choice, had survived the rice fields of Southeast Asia, only to return home, and could not survive the state of Missouri. Of course, all the 28 men that have been put to death in this state, I knew for years and years. And literally, there is no death row here. This is one of the few states where capital inmates are out and about with general population inmates. Missouri is rather progressive in that regard.
I saw a video about your case where you were describing, was it the death, the execution of Tiny?
Tiny Mercer, George Mercer, yes.
Yes, where you were describing what happened at the moment he died, that the rest of you were watching television?
At that point in time, that was the one execution that took place at the main facility in Jefferson City. And he was the first person executed in the state of Missouri since 1960-something. It was a wake-up call, and, of course, the institution wasn't sure just how to implement their protocol at that time. So what they did is they rented out some soft porn and aired it on the closed-circuit channel. And I think their thinking on this was that it would distract the men and not have them thinking about what was taking place some 100 yards away. Yeah, it didn't work then, and didn't work in the successive times.
This call originated from a correctional facility.
There's just no avoiding thinking about what's taking place at that very moment in time.
Are you locked down 23 hours a day?
Not any longer.
Huh. Because of how close you are to the date? Or
well,
no one?
Well, they've put me in a different unit, which is very controlled. But I'm out and about for probably 10 hours a day now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's to accommodate access to attorneys and so forth. But on the other side of that, they've implemented a new rule where men that have execution dates or who have run out of appeals no longer get contact visits. So,
have you run out of appeals?
Oh, I ran out of appeals last June.
Although you could still get the Supreme Court to stay your execution.
At this point, I don't think they can. I think I've exhausted everything.
So you're not waiting on any legal proceeding?
No, I'm not.
What words do you have to leave our listeners with, listeners around the country to Democracy Now, who've heard a lot on this show, and perhaps themselves as activists have been involved with the issue of the death penalty? What would you like to say to them?
Well, I'd certainly like to thank all of them on my behalf, as well as all the other men and women on death row across this country.
This call originated from a correctional facility.
We, as a nation, have to address the problem of crime and punishment. Each time there is an execution across this country, whether it's Sam McDonald or someone in Florida, Texas, et cetera, or myself, you know, it's a loss for all of us. And it's pretty well an established fact at this point that capital punishment is not a deterrent. It is nothing more than society exacting some sort of revenge. It's a knee-jerk reaction to the rising crime rate, and of course, to the rather conservative media sensationalizing it for purposes other than information. And these people that work to abolish capital punishment, a lot of them put their heart and soul into that effort. And not all men on death row are fanged animals lurking in shadows waiting to pounce upon someone. The men that are on death row, and women, are generally minorities, or people that cannot afford the dream team. They cannot afford their own retained counsel. And thus, the result is the state has a distinct advantage from the very, very beginning. And, of course, there are statistics to back up all of this. And we've entered a time when political correctness seems to take precedence over what's right and wrong. And it's not just the issues of capital punishment. It's a number of other issues. And we all have to address that, because if there's any hope of this becoming a better world for all of us, we have to open our eyes and see the bigger picture, not believe what our politicians are necessarily telling us for reasons other than the truth. Far too many people are building their careers on crime and punishment. And it's easy to inflame the populace with these crime statistics and, of course, the gratuitous, violent shot of blood on the sidewalk that we see on the 5 and 6 o'clock news. It's easy to inflame the public with that and then offer up these tried and failed methods of mandatory sentences, longer sentences, truth in sentencing, and, of course, the ever-popular capital punishment. these things are not working. Our tax dollars are being squandered on this.
A.J. Bannister, we're speaking to him on death row in Missouri at the Potosi Correctional Center outside of St. Louis. He has a date to die next Tuesday, unless Mel Carnahan, the governor of Missouri, gives him clemency. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with him in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The words of the men and women condemned to die by the state have long held a special place in the annals of history and literature. Today on Democracy Now! We continue with what very well could be among the last recorded words of Missouri death row prisoner A.J. Bannister. He's exhausted all his appeals and is now scheduled to die this Tuesday. Actually, it's Wednesday morning at 12:01. Scheduled to die by lethal injection. I got a chance to talk to him the other day and asked him about the status of his case and what his hopes are having his execution stayed. That's the only way this execution can be stopped by Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan.
I became aware of this execution date on September 24th. That was the very same day that the state of Missouri carried out its 28th execution since 1989. At this point, there's a number of efforts underway. My case has gotten a great deal of attention over the last 5 or 6 years. And I'm expecting a decision from the Inter-American Commission in Washington, D.C., which conducted a hearing on my case last Friday, based on a complaint filed by a British attorney. I'm going to the parole board at 8 a.m. Wednesday morning due to the clemency petition filed on my behalf by my attorneys. And there's been a large-scale letter-writing campaign going on my behalf for a number of years.
We've been talking to A.J. Bannister from Potosi Prison outside St. Louis, Missouri. He is on death row there, scheduled to die on Tuesday. So the governor, though, of Missouri could commute your sentence.
Yes, he could.
And do you have any sign of what direction he might go in?
Well, he certainly knows of all the facts relevant to my case. I've been blessed with a very supportive family and friends who have as I said earlier, waged a letter-writing campaign on my behalf, just as a reminder to him to show that there is some support and that people are aware of the facts of my case.
A.J., you got married in prison when you're on death row.
Yes, almost 4 years ago. In fact, the 29th of this month would be my four-year anniversary.
What made you decide to get married in prison, and how did you meet your wife?
My wife's name is Lindsay. And the first documentary that I was involved in, she was still living in England at that time and saw this on the BBC. And she took an interest in my case and she wrote to me. And we corresponded and I knew early on that this is a very special lady, that we just hit it off right off. And one thing led to another and she decided that she wanted to move over here. And she's been here ever since.
How has that been for you?
She's been a source of great inspiration to me. I mean, this is a tireless woman that she's been there for me all the way.
A.J. Bannister, how, if the governor does not sign a stay of your execution, mm-hmm. how will you die?
By lethal injection.
Have you chosen that means, or has the state of Missouri?
I didn't have a choice. That is the method
this
of execution.
This call originated from a correctional facility.
In this state.
Is that the method by which you'd like to go? What a strange question.
Well, not so strange as the rather silly answer I'd like to give. But initially when I was sentenced, they used the gas chamber in this state. But they went away from that, as a number of other states have, simply because it was too gruesome. They didn't want to affect the public with stories on how his eyes bulged out, his skin turned black. That's a very gruesome way to die. So they went to this lethal injection. And, you know, it's just not visually, disturbing. And I've heard people compare it to taking the family dog to the vets and putting them down. It's very palatable to the public. And I don't know that there is any good way to die. Old age be my way. Hmm. But
has the prison warden gone through with you each step of the execution protocol?
No. The previous one, who's no longer here, he was a little bit more humane about it. Our current warden, I don't have much good to say about him, and won't even fake it. He's the one that's instituted a number of changes in the so-called execution protocol, which now includes no contact with family and friends the last month, 2 months of a man's life. And this is in direct contrast to a number of other states, which do allow, are certainly more humane about that.
How are the other people in the prison dealing with your scheduled execution?
Well, again, I'm in an isolated unit at this point in time, so I don't have contact with the men I've known for years and years.
How many people face death at the Potosi prison?
How many are under capital sentences?
Yes.
I believe close to 100 at this point in time. At various stages in their appeals.
Is there a number people can call if they are concerned about your case, if they'd like to reach the governor of Missouri?
Well, there is a website on the internet, and I would certainly appreciate that if people would access that and get to know some of the facts of my case. And if they feel strongly enough about it, to fax or contact the governor of the state of Missouri and express their feelings. And more than that, not just my case, but there are other men throughout this country who are as deserving, if not more so, of having their cases looked at than mine. We run the risk, when we have capital punishment, of putting innocent men to death. And that's simply intolerable by any civilized society. Yet we allow it to happen here in the United States,
this
and that
call
has originated to change.
From a correctional facility.
And it has been established in the just since capital punishment has come about in the last 21 years that men have been sentenced to death who were later proven innocent. And, of course, our people in the judicial system like to point out, well, see, it worked because we discovered the cases where they were innocent. That's just the ones that were able to get access to the media or had attorneys that took the time to investigate their claims. How many people have we put to death who were innocent that we'll never know of? That's certainly wrong.
Let me ask one last question about Stephen Tremblay's book, The Execution Protocol, Inside America's Capital Punishment Industry, that does feature you as well as a few other people on death row at Missouri's Potosa Correctional Center.
Some of them are gone.
And he also does a video by that title, as well as a video of your life, Raising Hell.
Yes.
How did that affect the prisoners there and affect you personally, this book as well as the video? And you have a book as well, is that right?
Yes, I do. With Stephen's book, actually my meeting him came about as sort of an accident. He was here doing some research for this documentary, The Execution Protocol, and he had requested to interview some capital inmates. Well, of course, the staff here went out and sort of handpicked a few death row inmates that were visually rather frightening and were not exceptionally articulate. And Stephen saw through this and requested to see some others. And just on a whim, I said, yeah, I'll go talk to him. And from the very first interview we had, just hit it off real well. And as a result of his book, The Execution Protocol, which I've not been allowed to read, they claim it's a security risk, as well as a film documentary by the same title, a great deal of attention has been brought to my case. And, of course, this led to the second documentary titled Raising Hell. And in 1996, last year, I wrote a book myself, and the title of it is Shall Suffer Death. I took that title off the execution warrants that I've been given over the years.
What is it called?
Shall Suffer Death. And I just wanted to let people know what takes place within the system. Just explain a little bit about the appellate process, as well as what it's like to be here on death row. And, of course, I looked at some of my growing up and tried to hypothesize on just where I went wrong in this regard or that. And my hopes on that were that maybe some youngster, you know, will stop before traveling the path that I've already been.
On the issue of the Roisman family, the family of the man who died as a result of the struggle you were in,
yes.
I'm sure a lot of people are listening, thinking, well, he should have only had this much time, what has it been, 15 years, to live beyond that day, and you have. So what do you say to that and to the Roisman family now?
What I say to them is, I don't know that I can say
this
enough.
This call originated from a correctional facility.
I don't know that I have enough sorries in me for their loss, and I certainly understand that. The fact that, for whatever reason, their son, their brother, lost his life, you know, I am responsible for that, and no penalty that the state of Missouri can exact on me will bring him back, nor will it punish me any more than my conscience has and will continue to. There's no sicker feeling in this world than to realize that you've taken another human being's life. I have to live with that on a daily basis, and that will stay with me no matter what happens to me. I would like them to know the truth about what took place, that I did not intend to take their brother's life, their son's life, and that if the forfeiture of my life would bring him back, I would gladly do so. This was not a bad man to start with. And that's the worst part about all this, is in the aftermath of all this, I found out that this man was not even involved in the drug business. My anger had blinded me. And, of course, I'm no longer the rather irresponsible 24-year-old I was.
If you were sentenced to life without parole, is life worth living in prison?
Again, it goes to the degree of my guilt. The thought of spending the remainder of my life in prison with no hope of parole, that's as frightening as the death penalty itself. When you cannot even manufacture hope, that's a very scary existence. I'm guilty of something between manslaughter and second-degree murder, and neither of which is punishable by death or by life without parole. I can be sentenced to life on a second-degree conviction, which I hope to have my sentence commuted to. And that in itself is just a bit excessive, but I certainly couldn't complain, because then it's up to me to prove my ability to matriculate back into society. If I cannot do that, then I spend the remainder of my life in here. But at least there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It's up to me at that point. And where there's, of course, I've always believed that where there's life, there's always hope. And on a second-degree life conviction, I would certainly spend a great many more years in prison. But at least I'm alive and have the opportunity to, you know, try to make some amends for what I've done. And I just want the truth to come out. I would prefer to be judged by a jury of my peers, all the truth come out, and stand judged by that. Not just half the truth.
What time is your execution set for next Tuesday?
Well, actually, it's 1 minute after midnight going into Wednesday morning.
How do you plan to spend that last day?
Well, they'll put me in the holding cell a couple days before then. They'll probably put me there late Sunday night, early Monday morning. I'll be visited by members of my family, friends. And I'll probably be wondering if and when the governor's going to make a decision in my case.
Well, we'll certainly report on that. And I want to thank you very much for taking this time to talk to me and our listeners.
This call originated from a correctional facility.
Well, I'll be looking forward to talking to you again, hopefully. Maybe even the 23rd if I'm exceptionally lucky.
Thank you very much.
Okay, have a good day.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
A.J. Bannister, speaking to us from death row in Missouri. I spoke to him at the Potosi Prison just outside St. Louis. Again, A.J. Bannister has a date to die next Tuesday night at midnight, to be exact 12:01 on Wednesday morning, unless his execution is stayed by the governor of Missouri. That's Governor Mel Carnahan. That is the only out, that is the only avenue, the only recourse that A.J. Bannister has right now. There's a growing international movement, in particular around A.J. Bannister's case. If you'd like your opinions to be heard on the case, you can call the Missouri governor, Mel Carnahan, at the state capitol in Jefferson City. His number is 573-751-3222. That's 573-751-3222. Or you can fax him. His fax number is 573-751-1495. That's 573-751-1495. If you'd like a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now! Program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to reach us by email, our address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. And you can hear us on the web at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our New York engineer. Andy York is our engineer in Washington. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Thanks to Leslie George for directing. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!